My name is Caitlin Yeager, Director of Heritage Programs for Missouri Humanities. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon for the first installment of our virtual book club series. This program is presented by Missouri Humanities, and our mission is to enrich lives and strengthen communities by connecting Missourians with the people, places, and ideas that shape our society. Today, we will be diving into Vivian Gibson's The Last Children of Mill Creek. Vivian Gibson was raised on Bernard Street in Mill Creek Valley and has lived in New York City and Liberia. She started writing short stories about her childhood memories after retiring at age 66. Her work has been produced as part of 50 in 50, Writing Women into Existence at the Billie Holiday Theater in Brooklyn and published in the St. Louis Anthology by Belt Publishing in 2019. She currently lives in St. Louis, Missouri. In Gibson's words, this memoir is about survival, as told from the viewpoint of a watchful young girl, a collection of decidedly universal stories that chronicle the extraordinary lives of ordinary people. I am very excited to introduce you all to Vivian Gibson. Vivian, welcome, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Caitlin, for having me. I'm very excited.
Of course. Of course. So what we're going to do, and I'll kind of explain this to our audience, I've got a few excerpts from the book that I would love to go over with you, some of my personal favorites and some that I think were just very well written and very striking. A couple themes that I've noticed as I've read the book, and some topics about some general history about Mill Creek, your writing journey, and your writing style. So I'm going to go into some of those, and then hopefully it won't take too long until we launch into some audience questions. So again, I invite our audience to use the chat and the Q&A feature to submit your questions and comments as Vivian and I continue throughout the program. So Vivian, set the stage for us a little bit here. Where was Mill Creek? Obviously, you know, to those of you that know, it's in a very recognizable area right now, but you know, you look at it and you can't imagine that it was ever anything but what it is. So describe where Mill Creek is in St. Louis for everybody today.
Yeah, I get asked that question a lot. Well, if you go first to St. Louis University, because it starts at Grand. So everything on the St. Louis University campus on the east side of Grand is the beginning of Mill Creek. If you go then over to Lindell Olive, go east on Lindell that turns into Olive all the way down to 20th Street, which is basically Union Station. If you go south on Union Station to the train tracks that are parallel to Highway 40, 64, that was actually the creek bed, Mill Creek. That's another question. Was there a creek? Yes, there was a creek a long time ago. And then you come back up to Grand. Some people think that it goes all the way over to Choteau on the opposite side, on the south side of the train tracks or Mill Creek, back up to Grand Avenue. And the creek, a couple of hundred years ago, actually was from a natural spring that was at the virtually the intersection of Spring and Vandeventer and Choteau. So that street there that's named Spring, that's why it's named Spring.
Oh, okay, okay. And I printed out kind of a Google Maps of obviously what it is today. And I mean, this is most, if not all, of Midtown. You know, the big Wells Fargo Bank is you know, where Mill Creek once was. You know, the Drury Inn at Union Station, all of these places that are landmarks today are what once comprised. Yeah, Harris Stowe, exactly, exactly. So it's fascinating to me, and especially as an employee of Missouri Humanities, because our office is at Union Station. So, you know, I'm in this area every day, and especially as I've read this book, it's, you know, it's amazing to me to imagine it as how you describe it in the book, because you name so many landmarks, and you talk about intersections and major streets that are still there, but you know, but Mill Creek isn't anymore. So it's very fascinating.
Only four buildings remain from 452 acres. There is, of course, Vishon High School, which is on the campus of Harris Stowe State University. There is one church out of 40 churches that were in Mill Creek. That one church probably you don't even notice. It's also owned by St. Louis University, and it's on Olive. And if you go to Pappy's Barbecue, it's just to the east, kind of tucked away. And what you see from Olive Street is actually the rear of the church. The front of the beautiful church is actually the back of it. Now nobody sees it. And then there's a building that's just east of Pappy's again, which was not part of Mill Creek before. There's a beautiful ornate building there that was a laundry that's about two doors west of that. And an old factory that's along the railroad tracks just east of Grand. And those are the only buildings that are left. And I'm not quite sure, except for Vachon and the church, why they even kept those buildings, except I think there was some protest and people wanted at least one of the churches to stay.
Sure. Okay. Very interesting. So I want to talk a bit about your writing journey, because it's not a traditional writing journey. It's an amazingly fascinating, endearing story. So I want to read a very short excerpt kind of as we delve into this topic, because I think it shows the importance of telling your story and to start early. So this is from page 10 of The Last Children of Mill Creek. And it says, "I was 27 when my mother died in 1976. It was then I realized how few in-depth conversations we'd had about anything ever. By then it was too late. My parents hardly ever talked about their lives before we were a family. I guess they were too busy working and raising eight children to ruminate on the past. And I was too busy thinking about myself to consider what was not shared. Besides, I thought we had plenty of time for talking until we didn't." So tell me a little bit about your writing journey and gathering a lot of this information when, in your own words, you said it was too late.
Yeah. I think that was probably the impetus to make me write. And I was thinking about my mother, and I was 27 years old. I hadn't married yet. I didn't have any children. I felt very much like a motherless child. And I started writing about my mother and really realized, you know, how little I did know. So over time, it was just a matter of me just recording my thoughts. If you look really carefully at how the book is structured, you could almost identify the individual stories. Because I wrote this book over about 40 years of just jotting down thoughts and things I wanted to remember. Some of them could almost be called essays, but mostly they were just little stories, little snippets, few paragraphs, very few. Certainly not combined or coordinated in any way. So when I retired, I decided to clean out my office, my home office and my desk, and started finding all of these little writings and just kind of compiled them. And sooner or later, I had this huge stack of spiral notebooks and envelopes, backs of envelopes and yellow pads and that sort of thing. And I thought maybe I would try to compile them for my children. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to get a mailer from Oasis Center, which is a senior center in Clayton. And they offered a creative writing project. Our program, and basically what really convinced me was it said no writing experience necessary. So I decided, let me go and see if I can get some help pulling this together. And I went for a couple of years, actually. I enjoyed it. It's the workshop. You write and the fellow workshoppers critique your work, make suggestions, you go and rewrite, and it just turned out to be just a wonderful experience. I made a lot of wonderful relationships, but more and more the instructor or the facilitator would say to me, Vivian, people want to read these stories. I went, oh, yeah, okay. I'm going to put them all together. And then she says, no, I think you should try to get some of these published. You should submit them to magazines or literary magazines. I went, sure. So she really pushed me. I really resisted. But eventually, the St. Louis Anthology was requesting submission. So I reluctantly submitted something. And it was basically feeling like I'm not really a writer and I don't really want to embarrass myself. So I sent it. It was accepted. It was sent on to a publisher, the publisher at Belt Magazine, who also encouraged me and kind of walked me through the publishing process, which I knew nothing of. So I was reading books on how to publish a book, how to communicate with publishers, how to do all these things, how to even read a contract from a publisher. I was doing all these things simultaneously while I'm thinking, where is this going? And one thing led to another, and about a year and a half later, I had a book.
Pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So do you, I remember first hearing about your book when I saw the excerpt from St. Louis Public Radio, the interview on St. Louis on the Air. Yes. So was that right after the book was published, or was it kind of a precursor to the book being published? When was the book released?
The book was released April 20th. I had a huge launch plan with the Missouri Historical Society. We had already started scheduling events and discussions and signings and all kinds of things like that. Yeah. And then the world as we know it today appeared on the scene with COVID-19 and everything stopped. So I had a book, and that interview happened, I think, just prior to, I think maybe the day before we were supposed to launch. Okay. And, but everything had stopped. And so that was my first introduction. So now all these books I was reading while I'm trying to figure out how to publish, get this book published, now was, how do I promote a book?
They didn't say anything about how to do it during a pandemic, did they?
That's right. I can almost write that book.
Right. Well, and that kind of leads me into my next thing that I want you to talk about a little bit, how you approached promoting this book, especially since you kind of, like you said, had plans and you know, events and signings and ways to promote it in big ways, big partners, and then COVID-19 happened. And you know, and now we're in another crisis with the Black Lives Matter movement and police brutality. And how have you approached promoting a book like this, especially a book about Black history?
About Black history, and I've been in my condo for the last 3 months. Mm-hmm. So I'm promoting this book from my kitchen counter via social media. And I'm trying to learn social media as I do it. So I'm building this platform. I'm trying to get friends, get people interested, I built a website with photographs and events that were planned and then canceled. Lots of background on my family, but you have to get people to those things. So I'm just trying to figure all of those things out as I go. My publisher wrote something about me writing a book, and she said that I utilize social media like a millennial, which was a real compliment because I was constantly, and I still am constantly worried about overdoing it, you know. But I have, this is my only means of publicizing the book, so I'm hoping my friends don't get tired of me. I try to post some pictures of food and art and what I'm looking at outside my window in between, hoping they don't just, you know, shut me down. But so that's basically how I'm doing it. I work closely with the marketing department at Belt. And luckily we had done a lot of the pre-mailing out of the book, of the of the manuscript to the media. So that was out there. So that was a lucky break because some people knew about me. I was getting reviews and that sort of thing. So we were lucky. I can't imagine if I hadn't had a chance to do that. So people had the book in hand who could promote it if they were interested. Mm-hmm. But I still believe that my book was pretty pushed down pretty much after everything else that was happening. So it's just a daily kind of slog of, hi, I'm here, and people are saying the book is good, and hoping that people read it. People like you show interest.
So do you have plans to reschedule some of your big events once things reopen a little bit more?
Yeah, we're starting to do that now. It's still up in the air as to who will actually come out and when that can happen. I'm doing a lot of virtual book clubs where we do Zoom book clubs, and that's been fun. I've really enjoyed that. My very first one was a Pilgrim Congregational Church, and a number of the people in the church actually lived in Mill Creek. Mm-hmm. So those were, and they discuss my book over, this is a small book, and they discussed the book over three meetings, which was fascinating to me. So they were really in depth. And I participated in the second one, and that was really fun. So I'm trying to encourage people, book clubs, to do virtual book club meetings that I can participate in. But everything else is still kind of up in the air. We've pushed some things off as far as September, hoping that everything works out by then.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I want to take this time to read some excerpts from the book and have you kind of reflect on them. And I'm going to start with my favorite. And that is the description of the rite of passage of making cornbread. And what I want you to talk about really is how you were able to write so vividly. And something that you and I had talked about before this program is, I commented that so much of this book is so well described that I feel like as I was reading it, I could see it playing out in my head like a movie. It's so, your descriptions are great. Your word choice is wonderful. And you know, every scene is, you set the scene so well. You can see your bedroom, you can see your kitchen and your backyard and the alley and all the other places you describe so well. So I want to take the time to read this, my favorite excerpt, and then talk about how you managed to do that. You know, what is your thought process with creating an excerpt like that? So, so this is the excerpt from the book. It's page 54 to 55. It's about Vivian learning to make cornbread. I knew my cornbread was good when Beverly commanded me, without the slightest hint of sisterly praise, make some cornbread for dinner. My oldest sister, Vern, had taught me how to make the golden brown disc of goodness using only sight and my hands for measuring. I learned to confidently combine three heaping handfuls of yellow cornmeal and one heaping handful of flour, half a cupped palm of salt, a full cupped palm of sugar, and the same of baking powder, two eggs, and enough buttermilk to thoroughly moisten all the dry ingredients. Vern was careful to remind me to add the buttermilk in small amounts until the batter was just loose enough to pour, but not runny. She repeated an important rule that Miss Savannah, her godmother, had told her. You can always add more milk, but you can't take it out. I patiently waited for the temperature of the hot iron skillet to transfer to the rendered bacon grease that generously covered the bottom of the blackened pan, mixing half the flavorful hot fat with the barely fluid consistency in the mixing bowl. I then quickly poured my concoction into the skillet. the sizzling edges of batter that spread along the bottom and up the sides of the hot cast iron formed an immediate perfect crust that filled me with pride. It was the same secret pride of accomplishment that I felt the day I realized the word yesterday was the first three-syllable word I'd spelled correctly on this Friday spelling test. Then I waited as the heat of the oven evaporated the moisture inward and away from the surface of the bread, and the crust rose slightly to a crispy ring of crunch. I'd know it was ready when a shallow crack in the center of the bread formed as the last steamy moisture escaped like a dying volcano. When I placed a big wedge of my creation on Daddy's plate and announced, "I made the cornbread," Mama smiled. Daddy would take a big bite and proclaim, "My baby sure can cook." So talk a little bit about writing a scene like that, something to where description is everything. You know, to others, it's just making cornbread. But for you, it was a rite of passage. It was a tradition. It meant something. So talk about, you know, excerpts like that, that, you know, storytelling was really the be all end all.
Well, if you ask my children, everything is a story with me. It's how I communicate, I think. But in writing, I actually do see pictures. I envision these scenes in my head. I look at them. I visualize them, and I write the details that I see. It's how I do it. If I had maybe taken creative writing courses, maybe I could give you a better explanation of how that happens. But it really is me visualizing what I'm thinking about, what I see, the faces, I see the rooms, the surroundings, I smells, and I just literally write down what's going on in my mind, in my mind's eye. And all of these things are important to me. Learning to cook was really important. When you have 8 kids in the family, it's hard to be noticed, and especially if you're one of the younger ones. And I wanted a place, I wanted to be noticed. And cooking came very easily to me. I was interested in it, and we had to do it. My sisters did it, I was the younger one, so I was waiting for my turn to do it. So it became very important to me that I did it well. And so these are all very vivid images and memories in my mind. So I just describe them.
Do you still make cornbread that way?
Yeah, I don't measure. I'm one of those scratch cookers. So when people say, as my son called me a cooker. So when people say, "What's the recipe?" I don't know. I can't tell you because I don't know. It's a handful.
Mm-hmm. So another theme that I noticed kind of, at least more than once, a few times, I guess you could say, in the book is gender roles. And what I found fascinating was, it was almost as if your parents, their upbringing kind of reversed gender roles. So you have this description on page 28, the only child of a woman who was away from sunup to sundown, taking care of the domestic needs of others. Daddy was left to cook, wash, and clean for himself as a child, so he had rules for cleaning the house, especially the kitchen. That was a good thing because Mama's indulgent upbringing had not prepared her to be interested in nor proficient at any of those activities. And then one other, that's your parents, and we'll stop there because the other one's about you. Talk a little bit about growing up with your mom and dad.
Well, that's interesting. I've never heard it expressed in that way. But my mother had a much more privileged upbringing and didn't have to do those things. Mm-hmm. Her mother stayed home. Her father was a businessman in this small town, and they were fairly well off. And so cooking and cleaning and doing those sorts of things just was not something she did. And when she became a mother of a lot of children, it was not something that was even she was that interested in. She was an artist. She was very creative, and that's what she liked to do. And she was fun. And so if you came to her with a building project or a writing project or something like that, she was there to participate. But she was also a manager. I think I write that. She was a manager of children. So she knew it had to be done. She wasn't interested in doing it, but she could make schedules and show you how to do it and make sure it got done, because it was really important to my father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the way that you talk about your mom and dad in the book are, you know, just the way you pepper the story with these little descriptions that might not seem much like much, especially when you talk about your mother's appearance and then your father's work ethic. And it's really endearing. And you can tell that you were extremely proud of your parents. And I think that's really wonderful to read, especially for something that's autobiographical. So it's very clear that you looked up to them.
Go ahead. Okay, that's very true. We lived in a small enclave, and so everybody around you were very familiar with how other people lived. My parents were always there, and that was all we knew. So I mean, it wasn't anything unusual that we thought of. But they seem to be able to give us what we need. It's an interesting thing I was thinking about the other day. When I wrote this book, I didn't expect to think about my father in the way that I did. First of all, I wasn't a book to start with, so these stories were already compiled. So when it all got together, there started to be a real realization about my father and his role that I had never really thought about before. Because he was working all the time and providing. And as I would write sometimes a story, I'd go, wow, myself, you know, that there is one point where my father had several jobs and was going to school at night. Mm-hmm. Going to music classes at night. And I had a discussion with my brother once, and he said, Daddy was, wow. We both came to this realization at the same time, both in our 70s by then, thinking how impressive my father was. And I get comments from people about my father. That was, all of that is a surprise, and was a surprise to me, that my father came off as really, really a valued part of our upbringing that we just totally dismissed. He just did it, and we accepted it and thought there was nothing to it until being adults ourselves, having raised children, and realized what it took, and that he did it.
The other little piece that stuck out to me, especially kind of as this, you know, this kind of gender roles, I guess you could say, maybe not gender roles, but about you wanting to learn how to swing an axe. I loved that. And I also loved how, so this is on page 51, and you said, on the outside watching, I wanted to learn how to swing that axe, even though it was almost as long as I was tall. As usual, the key for me entering the realm of boydom was to wait for Randall to leave and to ask for Honey's help. And then later on, it says down the page, years later, when I was about a foot taller than the beckoning axe, I learned to choke up on the smooth curve of the handle the same way I did a baseball bat. I'd flex my knees, shift my weight slightly while raising that most basic of tools up over my head and down in one sweeping motion to split logs like a boy. So talk a little bit about your relationship with your brothers and how having, you know, older brothers, you know, multiple brothers, I guess you could say, kind of influenced you to want to do things that weren't, you know, typical for a young girl at the time.
Yeah, I wanted to do everything. I think it all had to do with, again, getting attention. And I had brothers, but sisters can be a little more dismissive. My brother, Honey, was shy and very kind. And he paid me probably more attention than anyone else. So when I would ask for his help, I knew I could get it from him. But I just wanted to do what everybody else was doing. So if the boys were chopping wood, I'm thinking, I can do that. And it's basically probably my mantra in life is, I can do that and find out how to do it. And I don't think I even thought about gender roles. It's really, I want to learn how to do this. And I just set out to figure out how to get it done. And the easiest way is to ask Honey, how to do it.
That's super sweet, because I have an older brother, so I can relate that, you know, there were things I wanted to do purely because my brothers did it, and I wanted to, and I thought, well, if he can do it, so can I. Yeah. You know, what difference does it make? So right. It's really nice to see kind of how you describe your relationships with each of your siblings, because I feel like every relationship was so different. How has that kind of evolved as you grew up?
Yeah, they were all different. They were individuals, and they had to be interacted with in individual in different ways. Mm-hmm. But I think it probably prepared me for real life. I mean, I had to negotiate just about every relationship and everything that happened. We lived in this close environment together, and you had to find your own space. I mean, if sometimes I think I also write about just being in my bunk bed with my turn to the wall just to have some privacy. And I was just able to negotiate life and learn how to work with people and around people and through people. And I think that was all because of those relationships with my siblings.
So this question from one of our audience members fits in nicely to this question about, or this topic about your siblings. Have all of your siblings read your book, and what were their reactions?
I get asked that a lot.
I bet. Yeah.
They're in the process. I'm getting calls. I just had two this week. My younger brother, Furman, doesn't remember anything. He's 18 months younger than me, which means he was about 7 and a half when we moved away. Mm-hmm. And he says he didn't remember anything. Then he started, I do remember this, thus and so. So he's finished it. And so we have conversations about how they're depicted in the book, but what they remember in relationship to what I said. So there's some comparison there. I have a sister. So some of them have, and some of them are in the process. And there are just, for the most part, it's been good. It's been good. They have some questions. It usually spins off into, well, do you remember this? And do you remember that? And so it's encouraging them to remember some things that they had forgotten about. And they're all amazed at how much I remember, because again, I was second to the youngest. And they're surprised at how accurate some of my memories are, because they're older, and they thought that I shouldn't have been able to remember these things. But I think I'm pretty nosy.
And observant, clearly.
Yes.
So we know that Mill Creek was raised in about 1959. Someone is asking kind of about dates here. So 1959, Mill Creek, the demolition starts. But when, and I think you covered this in the book, but remind me, when families really started to move into Mill Creek Valley, when was that neighborhood kind of, I guess, established, for lack of a better word?
How old was it? Established as a black neighborhood, because it's the part of the oldest part of the city. So you're east of Grand. Market Street is the center of Mill Creek. So all the immigrants who came to the city really did start at the Arch. So that's where the fur trading places were. That's where the boats came in. So the city grew up from Laclede's Landing west and then north and south. So the first people living in Mill Creek were actually white people, or European immigrants, you know, Irish and Italians and Eastern European Jews. And so it was probably around 1900, 1920, as Black people started to come, as the city grew and white people moved out. Then it was there available for Blacks migrating from the South and moving in. So I would say a date would be around between 1900 and 1920.
Okay. Yeah, 'cause I do remember you talking about kind of that turn of the century, early 1900s, when a lot of Blacks started to move up from the South. So that would make sense to me too.
Right.
So that leads me into a little bit more about some of these questions people have about Mill Creek in general. Someone asks, and this might be the same question, when was Mill Creek a neighborhood rather than a commercial district?
I think it was always both.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were lots of factories. It was a walking community. So the Black people who lived there worked in many of the factories. Mm-hmm. So they could walk to work. So I think it was always both.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what else do we have? Will you cover what neighborhood features, homes, stores, transportation, et cetera, in Mill Creek Valley were like? So you mentioned it's very much a walking community. You guys walked a lot of places.
Walking community, but there were streetcars. Mm-hmm. On the major streets, there were streetcars. There weren't very many buses toward the end, until the 1950s. But there were basically streetcars. They had something, a kind of a ride sharing, similar to what Uber is today. Yeah. Where they had these large, almost limousine type cars that went up and down Franklin and across Jefferson, up and down Market Street, where you could just hop in, pay like 15 cents or something like that, and hop out anywhere, and it would be, and they just had that same route. But it was mostly streetcars. In terms of housing, it's exactly the same architecture as Soulard. Mm-hmm. And Old North St. Louis, exactly the same.
So the row houses.
The row houses, mm-hmm. There are lots of bricks. The sidewalks were all brick, kind of chevron patterns of brick. Some of the streets were even cobblestone. Mm-hmm. A lot of people didn't have indoor plumbing. There were outhouses still in 1959 in downtown St. Louis. People were using outhouses. Mm-hmm. There was not a lot of, as you got closer to Grand, the housing was newer. Mm-hmm. Newer meaning probably built in the 1920s, where in a good part of the eastern part of Mill Creek, they were built in the 1800s. The houses were 150 years old by the time Black people got to use them. And so there was no hot running water. There were no furnaces. We used wood burning stoves, potbelly stoves, some gas stoves later on. The houses that did have indoor toilets were kind of jerry-rigged and stuck under stairs and hallways and cramped spaces, things like that. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely the oldest part of the city.
Mm-hmm. So how much input did the residents of Mill Creek have when it became known that they were going to raise the neighborhood? I imagine not very much.
First of all, they've been talking about tearing down that part of the city for probably 50 years. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe part of it was, oh, here they go again talking about this. But it had been up as the inner part of the city became Black, the discussion became, we don't want people coming into Union Station and the first thing they see is a slum. So that discussion was going on for a while. There was a bond issue to facilitate the move, the tear down. And then I think at some point they realized, well, we've segregated these people here. If they move, where are they going? Mm-hmm. Because by that time, city and the county, of course, are separated. So they couldn't just say, we're going to tear down a place in the city and right. all of these Black people will go to the county. So there was that discussion about where would they go. Mm-hmm. The first bond issue, I think in 1947, failed. So they had to put together a campaign to persuade people that this neighborhood could be torn down. We have to find some place to send them. And I think that's when a Pruitt-Igoe housing project was came about. It was some place for the people of Mill Creek to go. I think only about 30% of the people who lived in Mill Creek did in fact go to Pruitt-Igoe.
So, and that kind of leads into something that I wanted to talk a little bit about, and that's when you moved out of Mill Creek.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to find in the book, and you can probably tell me faster that I can find it, which is where you moved from Mill Creek, you moved where?
We moved to an area that's now called north of Del Mar. It's in the western part of the city, just before the city limits, just before Schenker, okay. north of Del Mar. It's now called Hamilton Heights. We didn't use that name at this time, but they're now all these fancy names for neighborhoods. So it's called now Hamilton Heights. It was basically about Hamilton Avenue, north of Del Mar, go between Page Avenue and the city limits. They were beautiful houses, large houses, and by that time, Black professionals, school teachers, lawyers, doctors, judges had been living in those neighborhoods on a limited basis for maybe 10, 12 years before that. But once it was decided, kind of redlined where the Black people from Mill Creek would go, that area was selected, and quite a few people who didn't go into Pruitt-Igoe ended up in that part of the city.
Mm-hmm. And what I found really fascinating too was, and I'm going to read a little, this is a multi-parter. The first part is we have someone that asks where you moved from Mill Creek and how that moved affected you. And that leads into this little excerpt that leads into that. And I would like you to reflect on that if you don't mind, and to kind of preface this, you describe in the book that, you moved to a much nicer house, and it was kind of a very significant lifestyle change for you. Yes. So that leads me into this segment, which is on page 129, and it says, "We loved our new home and neighborhood, but there was such a stark difference in where and how we lived before in Mill Creek. It confused me. If we could have lived in a clean, spacious house with modern amenities before, why didn't we? I wondered, but I didn't ask my parents why. I just enjoyed our new life." So talk a little bit about that transition, because I imagine, you know, as a child, it is confusing to not understand, well, how money plays into it, first of all, and,
yeah.
and to move from a place like Mill Creek and kind of the home you described in the book to, you know, a very nice home compared to where you were before.
Yeah. Well, again, we were segregated. So it's all I knew as a child. Of course, my parents knew differently, but it was all I knew as a child. And at that time, I was just about 10 years old. So I was at an age where I could start to understand racism and the role that it played in our living circumstance. So those were the questions that started to be asked and answered. at that time, why we were there and how we got there and how it was different. It was never discussed openly, and I think part of that had to do with my parents being from the South and having lived in really strict segregated circumstances, dire circumstances in the South. I think in their own way, they tried to protect us from that. You know, there was a time in during my college years that I really didn't understand. I resented the fact that my parents didn't prepare me for racism, because we were so insular that I didn't know a lot of things. And so suddenly to find out that white people hated me was kind of a shock. Mm-hmm. And I wondered why my parents didn't prepare me better for that. I now understand certainly that they were trying to protect us from that part of life. And mm-hmm. So it was very different. So that was what was confusing for me. Who are these white people that I hear about who don't want to be around us? Because I'd never really seen them.
Yeah, you mentioned kind of a few different ways in your book that you really, you know, you had not seen very many white people in your life, you know, very, very few. I mean, I think you mentioned at one point you see a white person and you kind of question whether or not it's a white person because you just had so little experience with them. And especially since you also describe your mother as being very fair skinned. Yes. So it was confusing to see someone fairer skinned, and you questioned what, you know, if this was the white person that you'd heard so much about.
Is this the white boogeyman that I hear about?
Yeah, exactly. And you do kind of get into the subject of the segregation and the racism towards the end of the book. In page 130, there were a couple things that I had marked, and you've touched on this a little bit, but you say, as I got older, I began to understand more of my parents' conversations about the changes in our new neighborhood, the blatant segregation and benign neglect that plague our old community. They now refer to as new terms, redlining and white flight. So were those terms that you hadn't heard until recently, or they weren't really used until you were older?
My parents didn't discuss race. Mm-hmm. You know, they just didn't discuss it. They lived it. It was part of what their experience. It was part of our experience. But again, there was a way, that was a way of protecting us, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we just didn't see it. And so when it finally did become part of my life, mostly after college, because even later, I went to a Black high school. I went to Vashon High School as well. It was in a different location, but my teachers were Black. And so it didn't touch me until actually I went to college. Mm-hmm.
So we've got several more audience questions that I think we can get to. Did you notice, so living in Mill Creek, any community interaction with the police? And if so, you know, how was that relationship?
Again, as a child, I didn't. I don't have any real memory. I think my older brothers might have a different take on that. Police were certainly held in a kind of, how do I even describe it? We certainly didn't have a lot of interaction that I was aware of, mm-hmm. but we were contained. We as a community, we were very much contained. Mm-hmm. And I'm reading a book now that describes a lot more about the police, the relationship with police during those times that I'm sure my parents and my older siblings were more aware of, but it didn't touch me personally.
Mm-hmm. Someone asked, my dad talked about the glass bar. Do you know where that was located?
That was much later. There was, I do know the glass bar. The glass bar was part of Laclede Town, which was a kind of utopian community that was that was put together, I think, beginning in the mid-1960s, after Mill Creek had been destroyed. It was an integrated community that was designed to be integrated, a kind of a new society for downtown St. Louis. So there were Blacks and young Black and white families Black professionals. I think it probably lasted about 15 years. It was self-contained. They had bars and stores and schools and post offices and little playgrounds and that sort of thing. But it didn't last very long. But that was part of Laclede Town.
Okay. And you were quite young when you moved from Mill Creek to the Delmar area, but someone asked, what grade school did you go to? So I guess, did you attend two different grade schools?
No, there were lots of grade schools. Well, I went to probably before eighth grade, I think I went to like 5-6 schools.
Oh my gosh.
So when we moved west, I went to Hempstead School, which is on Minerva and Hamilton. And an interesting thing I write about that experience is that because we were all just kind of targeted to a new area, the school was overcrowded immediately. And so probably 2 years after I started that school, I was among some of the first kids bused back down to Mill Creek to the basement of Vachon High School for seventh grade. So it was surreal to sit in a basement at a school where you used to live and look out, and there's nothing there but that building. So it was just surreal. It really, really, really was. So I went to Hempstead, and then I went to Vachon Elementary, they called it. It was in the basement of the high school. So the high school kids were on the upper levels, and the elementary students were in the basement. Mm-hmm. And then a year after that, I went to Clinton Elementary, which was right behind City Hospital and Malcolm Bliss Hospital, in an area that was a working class white community where white people were starting to move out of that neighborhood. So there were just a few white children in this school. But even they soon were gone like the next semester. So I went to Hempstead, Vachon Elementary, and then Clinton.
So someone asks, what do you think was gained or lost by the demise of the Mill Creek District?
Well, certainly community, a sense of community. Black people owned businesses. We had churches, our pastors, our school teachers, our principals, our doctors, our lawyers were all right there in that community. And there was a concerted effort to allow that community to run down. I mentioned earlier that the housing stock was exactly the same as Soulard and Old North St. Louis. And they didn't need 450 acres to put a highway. They tore down from the railroad tracks all the way to Olive. And I think that neighborhood could have been revived and survived, just like Soulard and Old North St. Louis, and especially Soulard. I mean, I can walk down the street, I can walk down, say, 12th Street, Tucker, and see the very same houses, the same layout, the same bricks on the sidewalk. So I think it could have remained a community. And when people were dispersed, a lot of relationships ended, a lot of support for each other, for a community support. So I think that's what was lost.
Mm-hmm. couple more big things I want to make sure we mention. I have one question I think that we'll be able to fit in, but before I ask the last question, where can people buy your book?
Wow, we're getting close then, huh?
Yeah, we have lots of questions too.
Yeah, the book can be bought at any independent bookstore. You can get it on Amazon, but why not support some of these independent bookstores? Certainly Left Bank Books. As a matter of fact, they're signed copies at Left Bank Books. Ooh. I just signed a big stack of them the other day.
I must have bought mine before that you signed them then.
Yeah,
I'll have to have you sign mine.
Well, that was something we thought of because we thought we were going to have all these signings mm-hmm. that didn't happen. So I'm starting to sign the books at the bookstores now. Mm-hmm. But any independent bookstore, there's Subterranean Books in University City, Novel Neighbors. Hopefully when Progressive Emporium reopens on South Sarah, I See Me, the bookstore in University yeah. City. So you can buy it just about anywhere, and you can buy it from my publisher and cut out some of those middlemen.
So you would prefer people buy from Belt?
I want people to just buy it.
Yeah, yeah. And then you have a website.
I have a website. It's my name, Vivian-Gibson.com. I get a lot of people saying they wish they could see more pictures. That's where the pictures are. So you can go there and see my beautiful parents. You can see my siblings, some of our friends, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. See me?
Okay. So my last question that I think we can fit in, has to do with the title of the book. How did you settle on the language, The Last Children of Mill Creek?
Actually, I was discussing it with a friend who said that she was the last child on our street. And she described what it was like to go to school when by herself. That there were, you know, there was nobody else in, because the kids used to go in these swarms of kids. And she described one day about her being the last one on our street. She lived across the street from us and how sad it was for her to walk to school by herself. And that's where I got it, because we were, that last year or so, we were the last children. And it made me think that there were no more children after us.
Mm-hmm. It's striking.
Yeah, it is.
Well, Vivian, I want to give you a huge thank you for taking your time today, especially on such a beautiful day too. This has been a wonderful discussion. The book was fantastic. I enjoyed reading every bit of it and enjoy kind of breaking it down with you as well. I hope everyone has learned a lot. I know I did. In a place where I grew up. I grew up in St. Louis, and I learned so much from this book. And I'm always appreciative to learn a little bit more about the history of our city and, of course, our state, you know, as Missouri Humanities. So and I also want to thank all of our attendees for submitting your questions and comments. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of them. If we had more time, I would love to, but I'll try and submit some to Vivian, and maybe, you know, in a little bit we can maybe post some answers to Facebook and kind of a follow-up. We can do something like that. But thank you all for taking your time as well. And again, thank you guys so much. Vivian, thank you. I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your weekend. And we will see you all again very soon. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much.